Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The kind of heat we're experiencing in greater New York today is July 9th heat, not June 9th heat. That's why we may set a record. The floods in Arkansas, the fires in Arizona, the tornadoes everywhere where tornadoes are rare. Weather and climate experts are beginning to believe that extreme weather events are getting more common, and not just in the United States, and that this could have something to do with global warming, even though it's hard to trace any individual weather event to that. Did you see the very long New York Times article over the weekend on how climate scientists are beginning to believe that global warming is here earlier than they predicted and affecting worldwide food production more severely than they expected? The debate politicians are having over whether climate change is real now seems more disconnected than ever from the debate that scientists are having over whether it's coming earlier and hitting harder, contributing to food shortages that have pushed the number of hungry people on Earth past 1 billion for the first time ever, according to Oxfam, and that has contributed to food riots in dozens of countries over the last few years and to the unrest at the heart of the Arab Spring. One of the sources quoted in that article is a report by the relief organization Oxfam called Growing a Better Future: Food Justice in a Resource-Constrained World. So with us now is Raymond Offenheiser. He's the president of Oxfam America. Raymond, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to be with you.
Are food shortages growing in the last few years?
Yes, I think what we've seen in 2008 was we saw the first global food crisis, and I think it was a wake-up call to the world that, you know, there was something going on in the global food system that we hadn't seen before, and we began to realize that there were a number of things happening simultaneously. And you obviously have given a little bit of an intro on the climate change issue, which is in some sense the large backdrop for this discussion that the Times article featured. But there were some other things happening as well that actually have a longer history and perhaps important for your listeners to understand. Mm-hmm. One was that we found ourselves in a situation where we had persuaded the world that there would be abundant and cheap food indefinitely that would be adequate to meet global demand over the foreseeable future. And what we found in 2008 was that wasn't the case. Global food stocks had diminished dramatically, in part owing to climate change. We saw a seven-year drought in Australia, and we saw a variety of other parts of the world where climate was beginning to knock down some of the staple crop production we'd relied on. So that was one factor. The other issue was that we've now become more and more dependent in the U.S. in putting ethanol in our gas tanks. We're putting now, if most people look at their gas tanks today, they'll see a little red sticker on it that says this is a 10% ethanol blend. Well, that's coming from corn being produced in the Midwest. 40% of our American corn is now going into our gas tanks, and that corn is not going into the global food market, so that basically that's driving prices up as well. And then we also had in 2008 a global oil price spike, and oil is critical for agriculture because it drives up food, it drives up fertilizer prices and other agricultural inputs, and as well affects transport costs for moving food. And since we're now in a global market, food is now being shipped all over the world in tankers and big tanker ships, and also it's trucked into remote areas. And then finally, we've got this in 2011. We're finding ourselves with a new food crisis, thinking that supplies would obviously correct, but obviously that didn't happen. And we have a new feature now, which is speculation in the financial markets by hedge fund investors who are now seeing food as an asset class and investing in it and creating volatility in food pricing. So some of this is about
that is really grotesque, by the way. If hedge fund managers are driving up the price of basic foodstuffs, creating shortages for the world's poorest people, there's something really perverse about that, even if it's legal.
Well, correct. And this is something we've never seen before, and it's something that economists are starting to research, and there's a good deal of controversy about it, but it's serious enough that there's a team in the International Monetary Fund tracking this, as well as in the World Bank. And in a recent public statement, the president of the World Bank commented that, you know, they can't make direct causal linkages here, but what they're observing is that when food prices are – when there's volatility in the marketplace, they're seeing investors coming in to this as an asset class, and they're seeing a boost effect in global prices. So,
when we look at this as being multifactorial, food shortages and food price spikes as a result, there are even other things that I could suggest also belong on that list. Like, ironically, as the middle class grows in China and India and elsewhere, there is simply more demand for food and for more meat, which takes grain to produce, which sadly contributes to shortages for the poor as the middle class grows in some developing nations. And after the financial crisis that began in 2008, some conservative economists say the Fed's easy money policies push up commodity prices, because then that's where you can make money, and fear of inflation. And that would include food, which contributes to these shortages. So there are many, many, many things we could put on this list, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're realizing, and I mean, I think this is the key point here, is the global food system is currently broken, and that there are a variety of things that we need to do, and we need to do urgently in order to fix the global food system and ensure that we've got food for all over the rest of this century. And I think it's important for your readers, I mean, for your listeners, to keep in mind that our big challenge is we're going to be a planet of 9 billion by 2050, and the UN's projecting we'll be a planet of 10 billion by 2100. And so the big challenge for us is how do we produce enough food to meet the needs of that new population in a time when we're taking more and more land out of agricultural production? We have the increasing demand from the new demographics of the middle class in China and India that you just described. And we've got the resource constraints of being dependent on a fossil fuel-driven agriculture that, in some sense, is not sustainable over the long haul.
Right.
And where climate change may be creating challenges of weather and water shortage in the world we're living in. So this is a very, very serious issue. And I think the good news is that there's a good deal of convergence about the urgency of the issue, but we're not seeing action on the part of politicians with political will to kind of make the changes that are really called for.
And we'll get to what actions you think are most important. My guest, Raymond Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America, as we talk about rising food prices, global food shortages, rising numbers of hungry people after decades of decline, by the way, worldwide, but now an estimated 200 million or so additional hungry people on Earth since 2008, meaning the total is now above 1 billion human beings hungry at this moment, or without what they call food security at this moment, that number 1 billion plus for the first time in human history. And we can take some phone calls on this at 212-433-WNYC if anybody has some thoughts or experience. We could make an element of this one of our call-ins from everywhere for immigrants to the U.S. who may be listening right now, living in the New York area, who have come here from anywhere and have contacts with back home, wherever back home is. If you are hearing about or have personal contact with increasing food shortages, increasing hunger, you can call and talk about what you know from your country of origin. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I just want to get back to the global warming for a minute, Raymond, because it's such a fascinating piece. And again, the contrast that I mentioned earlier is really striking to me. The debate that politicians are having is over whether climate change is real. The debate that scientists are having is over whether it has actually arrived earlier and is hitting harder today, contributing to food shortages, than they themselves, the scientists themselves, had predicted just a few years ago. And of course, there's a lot of uncertainty in the science, but I see that the Oxfam report says that about half of the doubling of food prices that you see in the next 20 years can be attributed to global warming. How do you know?
Well, one bit of the work that Oxfam does is we are one of the top five humanitarian response organizations in the world. So we work in many of the hotspots around the world where you have humanitarian emergencies. And some of them are big ones like the tsunami that you see on television. But many of the other ones are more regional and are about droughts and erratic rainfall and hunger issues that are created by and increasingly erratic weather patterns. So just to give you one example, in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the things that we had become accustomed to was every 7 years or so, there would be a drought, let's say, in Ethiopia, and they ran on more or less seven-year cycles. What we're seeing now is we're seeing those cycles reduced to 3 years, and we're seeing more frequent droughts. And in other parts of Africa and southern Africa, we're seeing erratic rainfall. Usually you'd have very predictable rainfall in these tropical zones, and the farmers and the agricultural systems would be adjusted to, you know, to deal with that. Now, you know, the farmers aren't quite sure if the, you know, if the rain's going to come when they expect it and need it for the planting, or if at all. And then in some cases, we're seeing cases where the rains are coming in abundance in the wrong time of the year and flooding people out. So we're seeing all sorts of unusual, erratic as well as extreme weather patterns that was something that actually the climate scientists had predicted. But they don't necessarily make the headlines, but they do have impacts on agricultural systems and agricultural producers in these particular areas. And so that's where I suppose you might say groups like Oxfam that are out on the front line are a bit like the canary in the coal mine, sort of saying, hey, are we paying attention to this? And does this deserve more scientific rigor in terms of the impact it's having on livelihoods of people in these more vulnerable countries?
Sheila on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, hello. I don't think that the technology can keep up with the exponential growth of the human population. Is there any way to control human population? Like in China, you're only allowed to have one child, or... Well, that was
it's a great question. So, is population control one of Oxfam's recommended solutions? Population control is always a very controversial area.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what we're seeing is that we're seeing actually population declines in certain parts of the world, if you actually look at the demographic reports from the UN, you're seeing actually a slowing in population. But even with the slowing in population, the predictions are that we will get to the numbers that I suggested, 8.5 to 9 billion by 2050, and then there's a range that's offered for 2100. So while that could be a partial solution, I think the other one that is often talked about in the Times article emphasized was the technology question, which the listener also brought up, which I think there's a danger to some degree in the way we might look at this, which is there a technology solution? Is there a population solution? I think what we're learning now is what we need is a systemic solution that actually recognizes that we need to be thinking about a number of things. We need to increase productivity. And I think the important thing to recognize there is the international community in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s was heavily invested in agriculture and ensuring there was enough food supply. But what happened subsequently is we divested. For example, the World Bank and the U.S. government investments in agriculture were something like 40% in the early 70s in investments in developing countries and their agricultural systems. They declined to something like 3 or 4% in 2008 when this food crisis hit. We need to reinvest in technology and in increasing productivity. The other thing I think we have to realize is we've got to invest in a technology that is actually going to be conscious of the fact that, you know, we are going to be dealing with agriculture production in a resource-constrained world. And what I mean by that is with climate change and with increasing populations, we're seeing more competition for water supply, and we're likely to see more conflicts over water. And, in fact, we're also seeing conflicts over land where governments, for example, Saudi Arabia, is finding that its water supply and its aquifer is drying up. So it's now grabbing land and leasing long-term lease basis lands in various countries in Africa in order to feed its population.
In fact, we're going to do kind of a part two of this conversation with another guest tomorrow at this time, which is going to focus on water issues in China, where the population obviously is growing so fast, and that's related to all the things that we've been talking about. So part two tomorrow on water issues in China. Let's take another phone call. Saidu, originally from Guinea, now in Manhattan. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Thank you very much, Brian. I'm usually one of your fans, and I keep listening to the news almost all day from NPR. The problem in Guinea is that after the presidential elections, we have seen that even the new elected president accusing the traders of monopolizing the trade of commodities, because most of these traders were supporting the opposition leader. And it's become a very big issue because it's become like ethnical problem after the 2010 election on December. And even right now in Guinea, we have problem with the government company, which they call Sogi Farm, is doing agricultural in the forestal area of Guinea. And now even the people who are living there are fighting back to get back their land. And it's becoming a very big issue. And
so is this an example of food shortages that may not have existed 10, 20 years ago causing political conflict?
Yes, it's causing political problem because actually the president didn't help when he came in and he tried to accuse these traders because they bring the food from China, from Thailand, and sell it back. And the price went up and affected every part of the country. And, he accused them. But the problem is not that. The problem is if you look for Guinea, for instance, Guinea has like 9 months of drought, and Guinea cannot feed itself. It's the example of Africa wasting the resources of water or resources of natural resources to do something else and try to build the country otherwise. You know, we can't, Guinea could feed all West African countries because if you invested in agricultural land.
Right. A country that couldn't even feed itself today could be feeding all of West Africa, Seydou says, if they invested properly in agriculture. Quick comment on that before we take one more phone call.
No, I think it's a very good example of what we see in many of the African countries where we've had because of the divestment in the agricultural sector, we've seen the collapse of the institutions that were in place in the 70s and 80s, agrarian banks that were providing credit to farmers, agricultural extension providing information to farmers, effective market supports which were providing seed and inputs to farmers. All of that has disappeared as we've divested from the agricultural sector. So then you end up in a situation where the leaders of Guinea have been persuaded by the international institutions to agree to a free market approach to this, where they're dependent on cheap food in the international market. But what happens when that food disappears, and you don't have agricultural institutions in the country, and you're operating with a food deficit? Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of a characterization of what we see in many parts of the world today. And I think the listener was spot on, where what we need to see is a reinvestment in the agricultural sector, in small farmers. We've got 500 million small farmers around the world who are on productive land who could be contributing, but they haven't benefited from significant investment over at least the last 20 or 30 years, and that's what we've got to reverse.
One more call. Richard in Bayside. You're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Live long and prosper. Okay. Regard to technological solutions, they're going to be difficult. For example, climate deniers claim, higher CO2 concentrations will allow for greater photosynthesis, which means greater production of starches and other proteins, etc. That's not been seen. You can have an increase in CO2 absorption and assimilation, but the higher temperatures is reducing the actual yields in crops. And it's better if research and development focus on having varieties of basic crops that are heat resistant, drought resistant, so that they can tolerate a lot of moisture, flooding, or low moisture levels,
mm-hmm.
drought. And I'd like to just mention, in addition, a lot of governments in Africa and also the U.S., we're not keeping track of which foreigners are purchasing land with the idea that they're going to grow food crops or energy crops and then export all of that. And many governments in Africa are actually colluding with foreign elements in East Asia, in the Arab oil states, and in the United States hedge funds. And they are buying up land illegally because governments in these countries can do almost anything they want. The local people would have to resort to
they have no power.
Resistance.
Yeah. Richard, you make a lot of really good points. Thank you. But did you say live long and prosper when you started your phone call?
Yes.
Well, may the force be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's end on this, on one of the points that Richard raises, and I think he raised a lot of really, really good points. But Raymond, the Times article on this last weekend put it in sweeping historical technological terms, the so-called Green Revolution, which began in, I guess, the 1950s or so and used more intensive farming techniques and helped reduce world hunger in places like Mexico and India for decades. Those techniques have been controversial in environmental terms because of intensive land use and pesticides and things like that. But as an anti-hunger organization, does Oxfam believe that there is a technological fix, more green revolution, more technology, so things can be developed, like Richard was talking about, like wheat that doesn't need as much water as the strains of wheat that are out there today?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, first of all, there is a role for technology, and we do have to increase productivity. But I think oftentimes what happens, and I think this might, if there was one critique of the Times article, it suggests, it sort of implies that, you know, there is, you know, the technology may be the way forward. And I guess our view is that there is a productivity challenge, and that we do need to invest in agriculture, and we do need to get yields up, and we do need to expand the agricultural frontier in the way the listener described by investing in drought-tolerant varieties, ones that are saline-tolerant, ones that are flood-tolerant, and that work is actually going on, and it's good. I think the earlier listener actually commented on and raised the question of is the research going to be moving new varieties online fast enough to keep up with the challenge? I think that's a valid question. I think we need to be keeping that in mind. But I think there are two other challenges which oftentimes
and we have 30 seconds, just so you know.
Very quickly, two other challenges. One is the ecology challenge. Are we going to produce an global agricultural system that's going to be respecting a natural resource and it's going to be more agroecological in its character and less dependent on fossil fuels? And second, and because these resources are running out. And the second challenge is the equity challenge. We could actually have abundant food supplies, but those food supplies could be feeding pigs in China and not poor people in Africa. And we've got to figure out how to deal with the productivity challenge, the ecology challenge, and the equity challenge all together. And I think the equity and ecology challenges were understated in the New York Times presentation, and hopefully they'll be doing further follow-up writing on that issue.
Raymond Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America. They're out with a report called Growing a Better Future, Food Justice in a Resource-Constrained World. And that report was cited in the long New York Times investigative article last Sunday on the relationship between global warming already being here to some degree and rising food shortages around the world. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for the program.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the persistence of racial segregation on Long Island, and then the politics of other people's positions on Anthony Weiner. Stay with us.